Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Dr. Daniel at BlakeRadio.com. Turn my volume up here. And today's episode, we're going to talk about false flag diseases. Not just any false flag diseases, but the next false flag disease. So just as there are false flag operations to get citizens to support wars, there are also false flag diseases to instill fear and submission. So today, I'm going to cover two new false flag diseases that are being released. So these were touted in 1979. So I was there, and I can give you the lowdown. I'm going to review the history, make some predictions, and share simple, natural responses that can allow you to keep your health, your freedom, and your sanity. So that's what we're going to do today. And let's dive right in. Well, first of all, I have to say, I started medical school as a rather naive, sincere and concerned 22-year-old, and I wanted to do the right thing. I was totally mesmerized and energized when I came to class one day to find that the nation was on the precipice, the very edge of a sweeping pandemic, and I, a future doctor, would be called upon to save the nation. Well, you can imagine, I took furious notes and was anxious to know what I should do to make a contribution and save my country. It seemed that two organisms were sweeping the nation, prions and mycoplasma. Only highly trained and disciplined doctors, such as myself, could save the country. That's what we were told. And the new symptoms, of course, were vague. Low-grade fever, maybe. A little bit of fatigue. And the tests, of course, were not very well developed back then. A lot of false positives, a lot of false negatives, but scientists were working on it. And, of course, there were many hidden cases. And for the sake of the nation, we needed to be ready to act. Of course, more news would be coming. I was definitely supposed to stay tuned, keep up with my continuing medical education, and be ready to preside over quarantines and various other necessary and monumental government efforts to, of course, save the country. So here we are. It's not 1989 anymore. It's 2013. And these two organisms, again, are sweeping the nation, so we're told. Of course, I was confused and befuddled back then, but I got a few years of experience under my belt, so you don't have to be confused and befuddled, and I'll share with you what I have found out. So I want to tell you about the epidemic that wasn't, and now that these two organisms are again poised to destroy the nation, I want to prepare you. So this is the second go-round. And I became aware of this when my husband sent me an email with a video, a Dr. Mercola video, of the new coming pandemic. And Dr. Mercola, of course, was alarmed and wanted to know how we were going to, what the nation was going to do about this. Of course, my husband was alarmed, too, and he wanted to know. He said, Jennifer, what are we going to do? So I figured I'd head this off at the pass and share with you the real deal. So when I watched the video and saw Dr. McCullough emphasizing the danger and imminence of the threat and how inescapable it was, I realized that I needed to add my experience to the record. Now, this video states that prions are in GMO food. They are in the soil. They're in all of our food supply. And it would not be long before we'd all be overrun with the serious yet unnamed illnesses they cause. Like, well, he did mention mad cow disease. Now, to get this in perspective, or try to, it helps to know what a prion is. First of all, prion is a synthesis of two words, the PR for protein and the viron end, or ION, from viron, which is a virus particle. So it's prion, a protein virus. Well, it's actually a denatured protein. What's a denatured protein? Proteins are sequences of amino acids, and they come in a certain order for a different protein. And once that protein is in a certain order, it then gets twirled up in a configuration. Then once it gets twirled up in a configuration, it gets snipped and cut. And so, and in this configuration, cut in these pieces just so, it can do all kinds of marvelous things. It can be a hormone, it can be an enzyme, it can do great things to really help you stay healthy. So denatured protein is a protein that no longer has this configuration and therefore cannot contribute to your health. So it can't perform its usual biological function due to its lost shape. A common example of denatured protein is cooked egg white. So, or if you boil your egg, for example, the protein, which was translucent, becomes a cloudy, opaque white. And that is denatured protein. I think anyone will agree that it's possible to eat an egg, denatured protein, and survive. Now, it's important to know that when you boil your egg, it reaches a temperature of 212 degrees. In other words, at 212 degrees, this protein is inactivated. You can tell that by the white color and the hard texture of it. And so proteins generally are kind of fluid, maybe a little thick, but fluid. And when they're denatured, they become hard. So most anyone would agree, we do not need special protection from boiled eggs. But here's what the scientists say. Scientists say that a prion is an organism that can propagate itself. Notice the word propagate, not reproduce, propagate itself. And it has only one strand of protein, cannot be destroyed by heat, even to thousands of degrees. And it's first discovered, and this is what I told in medical school, got to keep a straight face on this one, that a primitive tribe had a tradition of having its widows, in other words, women, when their husband would die, it was the woman's obligation to eat the brain of her deceased husband. The widows then developed, over a brief period of time, mental decline, loss of control of their muscles, and died soon after eating the remains of their husband. This was, like I said, a tribal ritual. I kid you not. And on this basis, all of the United States should rise into a panic. So in medical school, we were told that this prion then mysteriously migrated to cows, domestic cows. So in 79, this prion affected humans, it was believed, when they ate the meat of infected cows. Highly contagious, yet mysterious, and would sweep through herds of cattle, contaminating the milk and steaks, and ultimately destroying mankind. Because of this dreaded disease, every cow needed to be tagged and tracked by the government. And testing needed to be instituted. The government needed the authority to destroy herds, read that private property, of cattle if any tested positive. Of course, there was no cure. Now, this, as you might imagine, left me in a total and complete panic. But I was ready. I was ready to do whatever it took to stop this raging pandemic. So let's go to patient identification, then we'll talk about a recent article, Stuffing Mad Cow. So you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at blakeradio.com. Please visit our sponsor, that be me, and get your copy of Do You Have the Guts to Be Beautiful? This anti-aging vitality book is available at vitalitycapsules.com/truth-files. And get your copy of Dr. Daniels' book that has helped men and women look and feel 20 years younger. And as always, welcome your calls and questions, so please call in at 914-338-0695. Now, the most recent article on this matter appeared in 2006, so that just lets you know how active and exciting a disease this is. And that was the last time that an infected cow was found. Actually, it was also the first time. The first infected case since 1979 was found in 2006. And the next case in the United States was found in 2012. So Americans, it's felt by this reporter, are not at risk for the latest positive bovine spongiform encephalopathy or mad cow disease test, since the cow was not balanced with the nation's food supply, according to the Department of Agriculture spokesman who touted the agency's system for catching contaminants in food supply. Now, wait a minute. No, this is totally nonsensical to me. First of all, either the cow gave milk or was ready for slaughter. I've never known a cow raised for anything else. Was this one of the few circus cows? What about contagion? Isn't the prion contagious? Can it spread through the whole herd? Wasn't this cow's farm buddies headed for slaughter? Or was this the only herd of cows not raised for slaughter? It even gets more weird. So, as I mentioned before, prion is short for protein virus. We know that a protein has to become RNA, which has to become DNA in order to reproduce. So according to science, this is the system. Further, this prion maintains its activity even at temperatures of thousands of degrees. Wait a minute. Now, proteins have biological activity, and every protein has a narrow temperature range within which it causes chemical reactions, which are necessary to cause disease. So there must be a temperature at which the protein is not active, and obviously it must be active and disease-causing at body temperature. To complicate this by the fact that most all proteins, as I mentioned before, are inactivated at temperatures of 212 degrees. So we have a protein that reproduces and is active outside of the biological range. In other words, we have a protein that can do what no protein, by definition, is able to do. So how do we sort this out? Well, of course, go to the scientist. That's what you do. So when the scientists were pressed for more information on how a protein can reproduce, the scientists came up with this. They said the prion is actually a misbehaving protein and gets other proteins to act poorly and misbehave and cause disease. This one prion can bully other proteins into causing disease. And it spreads like wildfire, and before you know it, all the proteins are acting in a mysteriously disease-causing manner. So the one protein does not actually reproduce itself, but it reproduces its behavior in other proteins. Sounds almost superstitious. Well, what is the method then that this bully of a protein uses to communicate with other proteins to get them to cause disease? And what inducement does this bully of a protein use for intimidation? What do the scientists say? Not known. Well, if we're saying that a protein has the ability to communicate with other proteins to get them to cause disease, and then get those proteins to induce even more proteins to cause disease and take over a whole body, this must have an elaborate communication system to go with it. This is like a multi-level marketing organization without home meetings, telephone, or email lists. I mean, the communication among these proteins must be so robust and strong that it could be easily measured. Guess what? None found, no communication going on, nothing measured. But guess what? There's another class of diseases that very closely resembles the prion. And what are they called? It's called amyloid diseases. You can even call it amyloidosis. This is a family of protein disorders in humans characterized by wayward proteins that do not do anything useful. They accumulate, they clog up every organ you can imagine, and ultimately lead to death of humans and also livestock. So prion disease is simply a variant of this disease, but the prion is a variant that's not experienced by humans. And what about the amyloidosis that humans have? Is it contagious? Well, doesn't seem to be. What about the treatment for those wealthy enough to afford it? Well, the treatment is a liver transplant. This totally contradicts the infectious disease theory that the scientists made up for prion. And, of course, they could find no proof of their theory. What is a liver? A liver is just a major filter. This disease is just a failure to filter out waste products, and those waste products cause the protein malfunction. No infectious disease here, no epidemic. In 33 years since I was introduced to the pandemic panic, there's not been one, not one American infected with mad cow disease. Not one in 300 million, and that's over a period of 33 years, dying from the prion, credited with mad cow disease. Now, there was one death in Britain, but we're talking about the United States, just to keep things simple. So, but what did happen over this 33-year period as a result of the pandemic, of the panic instilled in citizens? Well, cows are now tracked electronically in labels. Public service announcements were instituted. Go back, you can see. Warning women, and really all citizens, were advised not to eat animal brains or animal bones due to the scientific belief that these parts of the animal harbor the prion of mad cow. Now, scientific belief is an oxymoron, right? If it's a belief, it can't be scientific. If it's scientific, it's not a belief. It's fact. It's proven that this was a scientific belief. In other words, an unsubstantiated belief held by scientists. But based on these public service announcements and based on the edicts issued by these scientists, it led to an epidemic of osteoporosis due to not eating gelatin and brain deficiency due to not eating things like hogshead cheese, pig brains and organ meats and other traditional dishes that include the brain of animals and actually fortified our own endocrine system. So it ushered in decades, at least two, of extreme illness in humans because of this unwarranted dietary restriction. So much suffering and much profit. Not a single life saved, not a single disease prevented. Now, lots of money was made diagnosing and treating osteoporosis, which, by the way, is a disease of men and women. So a summary on prions, or mad cow, is that it was imagined then and it is imagined now. It's not contagious, therefore. Ignore any and all public service announcements. Refuse any and all vaccines that may relate to this. Refuse any and all preventative therapy and even early detection, as there is nothing to prevent. Liver removes, apparently, the errant protein from the body, while also the liver transplants out the amyloid, a corresponding illness of humans. So amyloid itself is a waste product, and increasing liver function, cleansing, and a diet low in waste is the cure. Duh. So now, not a single quarantine or increased government power will be necessary to protect you from the coming prion epidemic, which most likely will pass you by. But protecting yourself is something you can do very well in your home. The true problem, which is malnutrition and waste accumulation with overload of the liver, is being obscured by what amounts to voodoo. And like any good voodoo, it asks you to give up your money, personal freedom, and personal defense as a demonstration of your belief in the system. The high priestess of voodoo in more primitive cultures would not exact as big a demand as the present government is. The final outcome is the same in more primitive societies where superstitions are beliefs or practices for which there appears to be no rational substance. So these superstitions, in this case the prion superstition, actually does result from ignorance and fear of the unknown, and that's exactly what it's designed to instill in you. Because the details can never be forthcoming because, of course, they're fabricated. So those who use the term prions imply they have certain knowledge and superior evidence for the scientific, philosophical, or religious convictions. And superstition has been deeply influential, of course, in the history of the world. Even in so-called modern times, a day when objective evidence is highly valued, we have, in the name of science, a theory of prions put forth which has no science backing it. and it's merely an irrational belief or superstition. And so the danger, of course, is only with the person who believes. So the first and biggest defense is simply don't believe. Now, personally, you know, I did believe. I mean, I didn't eat any animal brains, even though, of course, scrambled animal brains is something that the elders in my family did serve from time to time. I did not eat any bones or boiled bones. I didn't boil a single bone in my house in 20 years. All the time I had kids, poor kids. So what should you do? What can you do? It turns out there's a lot you can do, and it's actually pretty simple. And it might even be convenient for you. First, you have to love your liver. What does that mean? It means eat liver. That means pick the animal, whether it's a chicken or beef, those are the two strongest ones, and eat liver. What does this do? This fortifies your liver. Let's say that you're not into eating meat. No problem. There's plenty of herbs that help. One is milk thistle. Wonderful to keep your liver strong. Turmeric is another one. Turmeric dose is very simple, anywhere from an eighth of a teaspoon to a teaspoon. Drop it in whatever soup or stew you're boiling up, and it, after 20 minutes of cooking, it becomes activated, and yum, yum, you've got tasty soup that helps your liver and helps it remove amyloid and wayward proteins. Then there's vitamin C. How much vitamin C? That depends, but minimum dose is 3 grams. Less than 3 grams of vitamin C a day is just not really, you're not making an impact. So anywhere from 3 grams to 45 grams, depending on what your system tolerates. Next is B-complex. What kind? B-complex 50 is my favorite. 2 a day. Next is artichoke. The artichoke is a vegetable. Yes, a vegetable. And you just boil the artichoke, and you can eat the heart, you can eat the stem, you can eat the inside of the leaves. And it's a major liver tonic. Asparagus is another one. Oh, artichoke, how much, how often? Artichoke has a definite season. So I'd say an artichoke once a week or once every 2 weeks during artichoke season is good. Next is asparagus. Asparagus is wonderful. Not only is it a tonic to the liver, but because of its slimy texture, it's a nice lubricant and tonic for the intestines as well. So asparagus, plenty of water and 3 balances a day, and your liver will sort the whole thing out and keep you healthy. Next, eat clean, unprocessed foods. That is a tall, tall order, but you've got to do it. Now more than ever, there's just so much contamination out there. And prions are nothing more than denatured proteins. In other words, dead proteins, waste products. And if you're eating prions in your food, and you're getting a lot more of these. So what do you do? You eat food that's high in living matter. So what are you going to eat? You're going to purchase your food raw. So you're not going to purchase any cooked foods. That's number one. Number two, you're not going to cook processed foods. So buy your food raw and prepare it yourself. That may involve cooking, it may not. That's your choice. But the important thing is do not buy cooked foods. And many raw foodists are deceived on this. They buy dehydrated and dried foods. Well, those dried foods are cooked. That's how they get them dry. They subject them to very high heat, even though they don't tell you that. The next thing is eat organic. What does that mean? That means the food does not have pesticides or chemicals in it. I personally have become very skeptical of the organic label, and so I advocate, you know, eating the weeds in your backyard if you're not a good farmer, or if you have a green thumb, grow the vegetables and eat those. And, of course, you want non-GMO, it means no genetically modified organisms, no artificial flavors or coloring added. All of these wastes that I told you not to eat can overwhelm your liver and then cause accumulation of these chemicals, then cause the accumulation of denatured proteins, causing your death from simple accumulation, which is all amyloid is and all prion is. So there's not an infectious component to this at all. If you simply take efforts to maintain your liver, to keep your liver clean, drink water, and have regular bowel movements, you really have absolutely nothing to fear. In any case, even if you do believe in the prion concept, it's simply not contagious. So make love, not war. Time for station identification. You're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. Please visit our sponsor, that's me, and get your copy of Do You Have the Guts to Be Beautiful? This anti-aging book is available at kimberlycapitals.com/Daniel. This is written by Dr. Jennifer Daniel, and it has helped women and men look and feel 20 years younger. So be the first in your circle to get those envious inquiries and those admiring glances. Get your personal paperback book with free shipping at vitalitycapitals.com/true-files. As always, I welcome your calls and questions. Please call in at 914-338-0695. We're coming up close to the half hour, and we're going to start with our second organism, which is touted as the next pandemic, which is going to do us all in. And this, of course, is touted as being contagious, person-to-person spread, and just going to just wipe us all out. So let's try and fill the air here with a little bit of, just facts about mycoplasma. And once we have some facts about mycoplasma, I think we can start piecing together some kind of picture here. Now, when I was in medical school, we had a 2 hours of lectures on parasites and communicable disease. And, of course, mycoplasma was listed. And mycoplasma had very vague symptoms, maybe some fatigue, low-grade fever, runny nose, stuffy nose. The test for mycoplasma were not very practical. It takes about 21 days to get the results back. Even a rapid test takes 4 days to get the results back. Tests are not very accurate. And so if someone is dying of mycoplasma, of course, the test would not be useful because the person would be dead before the results come back. So that's the start we got of mycoplasma, and of course, highly contagious. The treatment for it was tetracycline, just for your information. There's now tetracycline-resistant mycoplasma. What does that mean? That means that tetracycline does not get rid of the infection. That would be about the size of it. Death from mycoplasma is not well documented. That's a euphemism for saying. I went back and searched the literature, searched the internet, and I practiced medicine. I was in the field of practicing medicine for a good 21 years. And during that time, not one case of mycoplasma appeared in the teaching hospital, appeared in my medical practice, not one. And just to give you an idea of how significant this is, a teaching hospital is a place where any health test done, whether it's needed or not, because all in advance with a very generous budget. So if you can't find mycoplasma in that kind of setting over a period of 21 years, that gives you an indication of just how prevalent the situation is. Hello?
Hello.
Hi, it's Dr. Daniel.
Aren't you still broadcasting?
Yes, I am. I guess I think I'm reconnected. Can you hear me?
I couldn't before, but now I can.
All right, great. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
All right, great. Okay, we're back on the air. I'm not sure where I left off at. Oh, boy, I should ask that. Let's flex it apart from the thing. Hi. Hello?
Yeah.
Hi, where did I leave off at?
Where you were talking, you said there was not one case in 21 years. Of mycoplasma, and then
okay.
We lost you.
All right, great, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
All right, not one case in 21 years. Let's see, where was that? Well, there's about seven, so not one case in 21 years, and I believe there are about 17 mycoplasma species that are associated primarily with humans. So some are considered to be commensal, means they hang around and don't cause disease. And they're found in the respiratory tract or the reproductive tract. That would be the area where you pee or have sex. But there's three that are believed to be or known to be disease-causing, and that's Mycoplasma pneumonia, Mycoplasma genitals, and Mycoplasma hominis. Now, the pneumonia causes a chronic form of bacterial pneumonia, which can last for several weeks, but is rarely fatal. And the importance of this, by the way, is respiratory infection that lasts for several weeks and is chronic and generally mild. This is usually confused, actually, with asthma or chronic bronchitis, so that's interesting to know. So if you have asthma or chronic bronchitis, most likely it's a mycoplasma. Death mycoplasma genitorum or genitals is a cause of sexually transmitted urogenital infections in men and women. Now, hominis, mycoplasma hominis, is also associated with urogenital infections. That would be sexually transmitted disease. And the other types of mycoplasma are not understood to have a role in human infection. This is important. So the disease causing of some other species, notably Mycoplasma fermentans and Mycoplasma penetrans, remains uncertain. It has been proposed that mycoplasma may be involved in the development of a range of chronic conditions. So it has been proposed may be involved, this is like really weak, of conditions including rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, chronic fatigue, and Gulf War syndrome. But none of these links have yet been proven. And demonstrating the disease-causing nature of mycoplasma is difficult. Now, if demonstrating the disease-causing nature of mycoplasma is difficult, and the disease-causing nature of something like prostate cancer is certain, when, of course, all available evidence indicates it's not a disease at all, in fact, it's a sign of health, if the establishment is admitting it's having a tough time showing that mycoplasma is a disease-causing agent. This is key. So mycoplasma are also common contaminants of cell cultures in the biopharmaceutical industry, and some are also clinically important. What does this mean? The biopharmaceutical industry is that part of the industry, pharmacy, that is charged of creating injectables. And these injectables are often contaminated with mycoplasma. So I said to myself, oh my God, let me find out what these are. So I looked and looked and looked on the internet. I could not find a thing about contaminated biopharmaceuticals. So I said, well, let me take a look at the other side. Let me look up test for mycoplasma and see what they're used for. What are they testing for mycoplasma? That must be where the mycoplasma are hanging out. Sure enough, hit pay dirt. So, what did I find out? I find out that mycoplasma is of major importance to the biopharmaceutical industry because they are a significant problem, a very common cause of contamination in vaccines. Amazing. And causes visible changes in the culture, affects its viability while remaining undetected. So what the mycoplasma does in culture is it actually interferes with the propagation and growth of the organisms the pharmaceutical industry is trying to grow in culture without the mycoplasma itself being detected. It destroys basically the future revenue of drug companies. So potentially affecting factors like cell metabolism and gene expression. So mycoplasma affects cell metabolism and gene expression. And there have been a number of studies to determine the prevalence of mycoplasma contamination in cell cultures. And if you'll remember, vaccines are grown on monkey kidney cell cultures and various other cell cultures. So the contamination could be as high as 80%, but it seems more likely the true figure is somewhere between 10 and 15%. So if you can imagine if 15% then of vaccines are contaminated with mycoplasma, how many vaccines would you need to get in order to have about 100% chance of getting injected with mycoplasma? I'd say about 6 or 7, which is far less than the mandatory number of vaccines for humans, according to our government. So this is clearly a very significant problem for the industry and could lead to serious economic losses. Why? because the cultures don't grow as fast and not able to produce as much vaccines. So most of the cell culture contamination is caused by 6 or 8 species, with human, pork, and beef hosts. Now this is absolutely amazing, absolutely amazing. Contamination usually originates from new cell lines, culture media ingredients, or from laboratory staff. In other words, mycoplasma is common in humans. And these are staff, so these are humans who are healthy enough to go to work. So the problem was first identified in the 60s. So mycoplasma contamination of biological and pharmaceutical products, very widespread, identified in the 60s. In 1979, in medical school, I was told that mycoplasma was going to kill us all. And now, 2013, there has been not one documented death. However, again, according to Mercola's video, we have no reason not to believe it, mycoplasma is again being introduced as a candidate for a serious pandemic. Now, it's been frequent, despite the 60s, there's been frequent contamination of food and medication, yet no epidemics, no deaths. And mycoplasma commonly exists in the human body without symptoms. It's only a problem in the immune compromised. Now, probably a lot of you out there listening to me didn't go to medical school, but I want to tell you, a problem in the immunocompromised is a word, a phrase we hear in medical school at least twice a week. Every disease is a problem in the immunocompromised, a problem in the immunocompromised. What does this mean? This means fix up your immune system and you've got no problem. More precisely, what it means is people under the age of 5, over the age of 65, and or who have cancer. And that's really about it, or diabetes. So it's not possible to prove that mycoplasma actually causes disease, and these are the scientists talking, because mycoplasma are often present in healthy people. So therefore, it's not possible to fulfill conscious postulates, being that you have the organism, you have the disease, you take away the organism, you have no disease. You can't do that because the organism is everywhere. So this is the conundrum with mycoplasma. A little station identification here, and then we'll get back to our program. You're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. And please visit vitalitycapsules.com/truth-files and get your copy of the anti-aging book, Do You Have the Guts to Be Beautiful? I wrote this book to help people look and feel 20 years younger naturally without drugs. So be the first in your crowd to get those envious inquiries and those admiring glasses. Get your personal paperback book with free shipping at vitalitycapsules.com/truth. Now, one mycoplasma infection that we do know does exist is a mycoplasma infection of the lungs. This is for sure. And so where do you go? You go to the lung.org website where I went. Diseases, influenza, in-depth resources, pneumonia, factsheet.html. I mean, these folks must make a lot of mycoplasma because it's a lot of trouble to promote it. Hi. Oh, let me see. I don't know if I'm back on yet. Hi, we're having a pretty big tropical storm here, so our connection is a little bit shaky. I'm talking about mycoplasma and the great difficulty that the scientists are having in proving that it causes any disease at all. Apparently what it does cause is a loss of profits to the pharmaceutical industry when it contaminates their cultures. And also there's evidence that between 15% and 80% of vaccines are actually contaminated with mycoplasma. And this is appears to be the real issue with mycoplasma. And so the probability of mycoplasma causing a pandemic is just about zero in the absence of vaccines. In introducing a pandemic at this point, or the concept of a pandemic with mycoplasma, serves to conceal the true cause of ubiquitous or everywhere mycoplasma, which is the vaccines. So rather than saying, oh, my gosh, the vaccines are contaminated with mycoplasma, let's stop vaccinating, no. There's a big mycoplasma pandemic coming. Mycoplasma's in the food. It's everywhere. People are picking it up, and they're going to be sick, and they're going to drop dead. And because of this mycoplasma, we need then to have the military take over the food supply. We need to be able to quarantine people to prevent the spread. We need to institute martial law. We need to be able to confiscate people's homes, their properties. Why? Because these things may be infected with mycoplasma. We want to protect the public. And this appears to be the end game. Because once you dig down into it and look at, okay, mycoplasma we know is everywhere, but where is it specifically? Where are the mycoplasma tests? And who's buying tests for mycoplasma? And what are they using these tests for? You know, there's one website on the internet. Their whole business is selling testing for mycoplasma to pharmaceutical companies. It keeps one whole business, and I'm sure more than one, afloat simply doing this testing for mycoplasma contamination. And again, I mentioned that the testing for the contamination is not for the safety of the end user, which is the person receiving the vaccine, but for the profits of the drug company, because the drug company can't produce vaccines as quickly when the mycoplasma are eating up all of their vaccine and stopping their cell cultures from producing sufficient vaccine. And so you have here really a triple benefit. The first benefit is to the drug company that they're allowed to continue to produce vaccines that are infected with mycoplasma, and of course profits go up. So that's a benefit to the drug company on one level. The benefit on the other benefit is a benefit to the government, in that people, if they believe that this is truly an infectious thing, you know, it's person-to-person spread, then they're going to give up their personal freedoms. They're going to say, wait a minute, we need to be able to have the military go from house to house, go from door to door, break into people's homes, force them to take drugs, force them to get more vaccines, which, of course, no one's told are contaminated with mycoplasma, force them to take more drugs, remove all their belongings from the home under the pretense, of course, it is contaminated, and deprive them of their liberty, of their property, and maybe even their life, depending on how far the hysteria allows the government to go. And if we look at the internment of the Japanese in the United States during World War II, we can see that when we allow martial law to proceed like this, it can really get very much out of hand. So it has the benefit of increasing government power, of increasing drug company profits, and of actually creating even more illness, so people will need to consume more drugs and more medical services and allow this industry to grow. So that's the basic comprehensive view of the mycoplasma. Of course, you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. And please visit our sponsors. Do You Have the Guts to Be Beautiful? And get your copy of this anti-aging book at vitalitycapsules.com/truth-files. Let me just take some questions here. I have one. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi, Dr.
Hi.
Green. My name is Celine, and I have a question. Would you be able to tell me what could one use for, like, heavy menstrual, heavy menstrual?
The heavy bleeding.
Hmm?
Are you saying heavy bleeding?
Right. Exactly.
Okay, heavy bleeding. Oh, okay. Yeah, I just did a few things. I'll give you that answer off the air. All right, heavy menstrual bleeding. That's actually a pretty common problem. There are many ways to deal with it. One quick and easy way to deal with it is to remove the exogenous or external hormones. That would be getting rid of beef and dairy. So that is going to lower your flow. The next thing to get rid of heavy menstrual flow is a teaspoon of cayenne pepper combined with a teaspoon of turmeric. Mix it together, put in some ice water, and down the hatch. And then add more water and chase. And that will generally cut your bleeding, at least cut it in half, and maybe even stop it. Usually it takes about 5 to 15 minutes to kick in. It works very nicely. So we have about 7 more minutes. If you have more questions, if not, then I have more to add. Now, mycoplasma has been extensively studied. And where they studied it is in turkeys. And what happened with turkeys? They had, they took mycoplasma, and they had these turkeys that were infected with mycoplasma, and they had not a single death. Not a single turkey died, although there were some miserable turkeys. And it's really important to realize that mycoplasma is simply not fatal. It is a misery-causing disease, but it is not fatal. And as we mentioned before, why create the illusion that this organism is deadly when it's not? It's not even good evidence that it's contagious. In other words, it's not good evidence that there is person-to-person spread. So what appears to be more likely is that it's exclusively spread by injection of vaccines or other biologicals, and anyone in good health is unlikely to be compromised by it. So what do you do? If you don't want to get mycoplasma, the first and most important thing you can do is don't accept injections of any kind. If it comes with a needle, say, no, thank you. Excuse me. I think I'll go home and suffer. So that's really important. Because about the only way to get mycoplasma really is to get injection. While it is present in the food supply, the types present in the food supply appear to be harmless. All right, we have another question here. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes. Is this for me? Great. My question is probably maybe on both prions and mycoplasma.
Okay.
Now, there's several things that you addressed that I'm curious about. If a person has, I don't know if they would have enough prions in brains itself or in beef, and a person maybe takes these in to his body and then has, you know, I don't know how often, sounds like that's really a rare situation, but would it be safe to say that your body's going to clean that up because it can't multiply anyway within a certain,
correct,
and maybe with mycoplasma too? Okay. So then, if you wanted to assure, you know, relatives that, you know, eating cow or beef is not going to be a source of that, it would make sense to say, well, even if you had it, you know, but there's still objection maybe that, well, how about these other cases which they had it?
What other cases? There's not a single case, no reported case in the United States.
Okay.
None.
Okay. And they,
none. It's 33 years.
Would they, I mean, how about Britain? I've heard of that.
Britain had one case in 33 years.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
If you could, one other thing. There's a Mark Purdy seems to say prions have been used as a kind of a hiding the fact that organophosphate pesticides are really causing all these symptoms. But then that would obviously be, it wouldn't show up in a blood test or a biopsy, things like that, I guess. And so I suppose maybe that wouldn't even be an issue. Maybe they're just, I don't know, showing up some bogus cases anyway, I guess. But, okay, that makes sense. If they haven't had to confirm cases, then it's not a non-issue.
Yeah, really. You take it off your radar.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
You're welcome. I wanted to talk about a couple questions that you raised, actually. First is this Mark Purdy talks about organic phosphates as being the cause. That actually is very likely. What's really going on is there are a lot of toxins in our environment being put there by industry, And these toxins are causing a lot of diseases and even death. And so in order to cover that up, what's being blamed for it is, you know, the infectious disease. So they're posturing an infectious origin. Because people are sick. People are miserable. There's no denying that. But what they want to do is get people to attribute that to an infectious prion and give the government military, police state powers to protect them. And so the thing to understand is this is absolutely not infectious. The prion and the mycoplasma are not capable of causing any substantial disease. And we know this because we've got a 33-year history at least. And in the case of mycoplasma since the 1960s, there has not been substantial, or put it at this point, life-threatening illness caused by these diseases. So for mycoplasma, for sure, don't get any injections because that is the basic reservoir where mycoplasma is. And you can use the same liver-strengthening strategy that you use to prevent protein accumulation. That's really, really important not to do that. All right, well, what we're going to do is I'm going to start recording these shows. So everyone's going to get an email letting you know about next week's